you say you were originally going up to Somerville. Was your family a sort of university family, and was it quite a usual thing?
No. I didn't know my father. My father died when I was about 3 months old, and my mother married again when I was 8, and we then left London, where we were living, and went to live in Glasgow, where my stepfather had a business.
So it was really quite a jolt for you at the age of 8, I imagine.
Quite a jolt. Well, I suppose it was. I went to a high school in Glasgow, and I was very fortunate in having a teacher who knew how to impart what she knew. And she was an English teacher, and I wanted to read English. I was interested in that above anything else. So I find it very difficult to say why I became a kind of rebel and joined the Women's Social and Political Union. I really do.
You were interested in literature, and you were thinking of going up to Somerville to read literature.
To reading, yes, that's what I wanted to read. And I thought I wanted to be a writer, and I still think maybe I'm a writer monkey.
And the your stepfather's financial problems.
This was it. Yes.
Prevented you from.
Yes.
Did you actually, Miss Martin? Do say if you don't want me to ask you, but is your stepfather's name Morrison, or was it your
real father? No, this is my father's name. Yes.
I see. Yes. So you kept your father's name.
My father was born in Aberdeen, and I didn't know him. His sisters naturally thought he was everything that was wonderful, because if you die when you're very young, people do, you know. Yeah.
Good recipe for fame.
So I only knew about him from them, and he sounded a really lovely person. And I think it's a great want in your life not to know your father.
Yes, I'm sure. Why did they speak highly of him?
He was everything, anything that they liked in me, they said, just like your father. And I think he may have been a very attractive personality.
Mm. It must be rather galling for that to be said, never having known him. You must burst to know him.
I would like to know him. And as I didn't really... Well, my mother didn't really talk about him very much, and then she married again, and had a really sad misfortune with my stepfather, who was an alcoholic.
Oh, yeah.
Eventually died of that. So we didn't have a very happy childhood, my sister and I.
You had one sister, did you?
Yes, I have one sister, and she's still alive.
Is she? Mm.
Yes, she lives in Glasgow, actually, or near Glasgow.
Mm.
She married, had two children, and one of her children is Joan Eardley, who was, unfortunately, she died very young, at the age of 43, a painter of some repute.
Yes, I'm not really au fait with the painting world,
yes,
as I suspect
yes,
it should be.
Yes.
So it's a very artistic family.
That's one of her student pictures of Florence. It was when she was a student. She won a scholarship and went abroad, and that's just one of her drawings.
With the roofs.
Particularly, yes, it's Florence.
Yes. Anyway.
Yes, well, now that's me. I'm not very important.
It's interesting to see how you moved towards OSU, because a lot of artistic people did.
Yes.
I mean, it seems to me to be an organisation which had a lot of artists and writers in it, musicians even.
Yes.
I wondered whether it was the artistic connections of your family that led you there, really. And how did you first sort of get involved?
I find this very difficult to answer. I suppose, you see, at the time of the militant suffrage movement, it was very much a news story. The breaking of windows and the selling of the suffragette on the streets. That was their paper. And I heard Mrs. Pankhurst speak whilst I was still in Glasgow. And she was a really remarkable orator. Others have told you this, of course. They must have. She and Lloyd George are the people that I put absolutely at the top of first-class speakers, begin very quietly and then suddenly you're absolutely caught.
What, by the beauty of the voice?
Well, she had a lovely voice, and of course she was very beautiful, Emmeline Pankhurst. Mm. Very beautiful to look at.
Mm. And beautifully dressed, of course.
Yes,
she always?
Yes, in the period.
Yes.
You know, big hats and
yes.
long
yes.
skirts. And
yes.
It is totally untrue what all the cartoons made us out to be. One of the things that we were told, we young people who joined, was that we were not to look like cranks. We were not to dress like men with collars and ties and tweed suits and elastic-sided boots. I don't think men have those nowadays. But it's really quite untrue, and yet all the cartoons of the time tended to make us all look like so we were imitating the male sex.
You actually were told that when
oh,
you
yes.
joined, weren't you?
Oh yes, yes. Not to behave like cranks, not to look like.
Mm.
Not to give any opportunity to anybody to say that we were.
Well, that's absolutely right, isn't it? Because
yes.
that's a
yes.
marvellous way of diverting attention
yes.
from the main issue
yes.
by going on about the clothing
yes.
of people.
And we were also not allowed. It was one of the rules of the Women's Social and Political Union that you were not to do anything that would get you into prison until you were 21. I was 21 when the war started. So I was still just a kind of follower who went around and gave out leaflets, carried posters. I didn't do any smashing of windows. Whether I would have been brave enough to do that or not, I now can't tell you, you see.
It was rather nice you didn't ever have to go through the test,
that's
on it. I'm
true,
sure I would
yeah.
dislike that
that's
too.
True, yeah.
But how did you join then? I mean, did you actually sign something?
Oh
or
yes,
what?
I think so.
You went along to a meeting or something, did you, in Glasgow?
There was an office.
Mm.
In almost, I think this is true of almost all the towns.
Mm.
That they had something that was an office.
Mm.
It might be just a shop front.
And you sort of signed on or something,
yes,
did you?
Yes.
And then did you go to meetings sort of once a week or something like that, or what?
I don't think so.
Because you were fairly
yes.
young, weren't you?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, I was quite young, yes.
Yes.
Can't remember going to regular meetings, but I can remember going to the office and being allowed to give out leaflets or carry a poster advertising mm-hmm. meeting.
Mm.
Not any of the things that might get you into jail.
Mm. Mm. So you were, the younger people were used
yes.
in a way for
yes.
Routine jobs like that, were they?
Oh, I think so, yes.
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 Yes. Yes. Was there anyone who was sort of prominent in the branch who influenced you at all at that stage? Any leading person?
I don't think so. Well, if
mm.
there were, I can't remember.
Mm. Because mm. the WSP was always quite strong in Scotland, as I remember.
Yes, it was.
Mm.
Oh, yes.
We're going to have a tremendous storm.
Something
it?
Awful is going to happen, isn't it? Will that be on the tape?
It's pouring with rain. Anyway, it won't do any harm here. anyway, you joined, and then the war happened. What were you doing while you, in those 3 years, while you... After you'd left school, you left school, I suppose.
Ah, I took a business training course, and I was just a typist.
Mm.
Mm. I'm still a good typist.
So you're in an office at that time.
Yes.
And,
yes,
I see. Yes. So, did you go with your fellow office girls along, or were you the only one?
No, I think there were quite a few that were. I don't mean necessarily influenced by me, but certainly it was an important thing at that time.
Of course, yes.
The,
you must have read about it in the newspaper.
Yes, I've read a lot about it. And of course the Fawcett Society, I'm sorry, I can't remember what it was called then, the National Association of...
the NWSS, yes.
Yes. Well, you see, they thought that the militancy was harmful.
Yeah.
And I feel a little bit now like that about the women's lib movement.
Yeah.
See, mm. I tend to think it's harmful.
Mm.
because it gets people thinking the wrong things. But at the time it seemed to me that, heavens, we've been going on ever since 1860 or whenever it was when John Stuart Mill first tried to bring his adult suffrage bill, and nobody had taken the slightest notice.
Yeah.
And I still tend to think that nobody would have taken the slightest notice. And I can't bring myself to believe that it was the war that decided them to.
Yes, it's a very difficult thing.
It's difficult to know, of course, isn't it?
The WSPU, I think, did speed things up in the early years.
I think
certainly.
So.
Speeded things up at the time you were members of, when they were pursuing their real innocent policy, I just don't know.
No, I don't know. I think there was a resistance, wasn't there?
Yes, I think in a way it invented lots of distractions, like, you know, people said, well, you can't franchise, people burn down houses and that sort of thing.
Yes.
But I don't know, and it's very difficult to say. Anyway, you joined, and as an office girl, really not. You weren't inspired by your English teacher, were you? I mean, she didn't encourage you to join or anything, did she? And she wasn't.
Not exactly, because of course I'd left. I went to boarding school, you see. I went to Wickham Abbey. But of course she was sympathetic, oh yes.
Mm.
Very sympathetic to the whole idea of it, yes.
Mm.
I think teachers and people who had to work for their living were.
That's quite true, yes. But you actually away at boarding school all your childhood, were you? I mean,
no, I was at my high school in Glasgow until I was about 13. Then I went to Wickham Abbey.
Did you?
Yes.
That must also have been a great childhood, wasn't it? I mean, because you're going right across the country, weren't you?
Yes, well, my mother wanted me to go there. My mother was English, you see. My father was Scots, my stepfather was Scots. And it was only because my mother married again that we moved away from London at all, I suppose.
You were born in London, then?
Yes,
were you?
I was.
I see.
Yes.
Was your mother actually keen on the women's suffrage movement at all?
No, I don't think so.
Mm.
My mother was a very conventional person, and not, I think, interested. She tended to be interested in what her children did.
Mm.
But she was quite a conventional. Yes. Oh, I was brought up in a very Tory atmosphere.
Were you really? your stepfather, what did your stepfather actually do? I mean,
well, he was in some sort of business, and he was a rich man when my mother married him, and we had all the ordinary things, nurseries and nannies and parlour maids and all that.
Yeah.
So it was a bit of a come down when this happened.
It must have been.
And it probably was due to his unfortunate
drinking.
Yes.
Did he give up his job then?
Well, his business came to pieces. I don't, because I was rather young and didn't really know very much about it.
Mm. So did he carry on with other jobs, or did he sort of retire?
He died, I suppose, as a consequence. I think this can happen. I don't know a great deal about alcoholism, but you destroy your liver, I think, or something of that kind in the end. He died in 1914.
However did your mother cope?
I don't know. I look back on it and think she must have been extremely brave.
Yeah.
First of all, she loses her husband when she's quite young. She was only about 21 or something, that kind of, left with two kids to bring up. And then to have that happen when you thought everything was marvellous. So she was tough, I think. Maybe that's where I get it from.
So did she take another job, or was there enough money left? You know?
No, I know. She had wealthy parents. And she was looked after, I think, or helped anybody.
So she stayed always as an unemployed,
rather well-off
middle-class
woman.
Yes,
yes, that's right.
Yes.
That is exactly the description of her, yes.
Yes. What about your sister? Did she come with you into the suffrage?
No, she didn't, but she was always quite sympathetic. She married during the war. And really only went back to live in Glasgow because my mother was there, and a kind of refugee from London. A lot of people ran away when the bombs first began to fall.
Yes, you mean the Zeppelins in the first war? So anyway, in the war then, you were still in Glasgow, were you? Did you...
No, well... In a way, I suppose you can say I was, but when I joined the ambulance, I was an ambulance driver.
Were you really?
I came to London then, yes.
I see. So you came back from the place where you'd been born?
Yes.
How did you get involved in that? I mean, was that because you were a pacifist or at that stage?
No,
or?
I wasn't really, but I became one. You'll think it's rather curious, probably, difficult to explain why, but I was on leave in London in 1917, and that, on that occasion, are you taping me over this?
Yes, would you like to switch it off? Or?
No, not at all, I don't mind at all, I just can't remember. Because this is how I became a pacifist, really. A Zeppelin, they were huge airships, and we knew that they carried a crew of about 60 people. This Zeppelin came over London, and somehow or other our anti-aircraft guns, which for some reason I can't remember, we called Archies, must have made a direct hit on it, and it was slowly falling, quite slowly falling, with flames roaring up. It was a truly awful sight. And I happened to be having a meal or spending the evening with some friends of mine in Harrow, and we went onto the balcony of their house to see this dreadful sight. It came down somewhere near Harrow, Potter's Bar, I think, slowly crashing to the ground, and all these people burning alive inside. And what really shocked me was not that they were... I hadn't been shocked to the same extent by all the horrors I saw when driving an ambulance. I mean, the wounded, the blinded, the mentally afflicted, hadn't shocked me like this. That was good-hearted, decent, kind British people dancing and clapping and cheering at the sight of 60 people being roasted to death alive. I know you may think it rather peculiar, but I was horrified. And I thought, so it isn't only all these wounds and things, it really changes people's decent natures, so that you hate human beings.
These were your friends who were clapping, were they?
Oh yes, and in the streets, everybody was. They were delighted. Mm. Well, they're Germans, is what they said. They're Germans.
And therefore not human, is that?
And therefore not human. Well, I didn't need to learn then, of course. But I said, that's not for me anymore. But I couldn't just leave. I remember having some long talks with the person in charge of the of where I worked with the ambulances, and talked about it a lot with her. And you may never have heard of him, but there was a Dr. Orchard.
Oh, I have heard of him, all right.
Yes.
The King's Way House. Yes,
right.
Yes. Interesting man, yes.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Well, I had been going there because in those days I was religious. And I went and consulted with him, and of course he was a complete pacifist. You know, and really he was a very remarkable man. I never quite got over it that he became a Roman Catholic. I read his book. He wrote a book called From Faith to Faith. And I was fascinated by trying to find out what had made him feel he had to become a Roman Catholic. Blind spot somewhere, I thought. But no, he influenced me enormously.
So he influenced you towards joining the pacifist movement?
I think so. I think I think I must have already been thinking about it when that moment came when I felt I couldn't go on anymore. It wasn't that I was doing any wrong or killing anybody.
No, quite the reverse.
But quite the reverse. But I was taking the place of a man who would go and kill somebody or be killed himself.
So what did that mean by your day-to-day life? Did you carry on driving?
No, I don't. I don't.
I see.
And there wasn't any conscription then for women.
Mm.
Not like the Second World War.
Mm.
And I could go if I wanted to. And I stayed in order not to let them down, but I
didn't quite understand how this ambulance driving worked. This was inside England, was it, you driving the ambulance?
Yes, I was. There were many of my colleagues went abroad.
Mm.
It just happened that I didn't.
So
we worked in shifts.
Mm.
And our main job was meeting the trains at the railway station, the terminus.
I see. So you were transporting soldiers, but after they crossed the channel.
Yes, to
yes,
hospital.
I see.
Yes, to the hospitals or wherever it was that they were to go. Oh, yes.
Yeah. How did you, Miss Martin, how did you ever learn to drive? I mean,
I had to learn to drive, that's true.
Yes.
Well,
Wasn't that unusual?
For a woman, you mean?
Yes.
I think a lot of us did then.
Mm.
I think that was the time. You would think it very strange. Everything was on the right-hand side. It was a right-hand gate change, you know, through the gate, not a ball like it is now on the left hand. And the brake was there too, and you only made hand signals. There was none of these lights and things.
Mm.
You did everything with your right hand.
Mm. Must have been pretty difficult, but on the other hand, there's less traffic on the road, I suppose.
Oh, far less.
Just
less of course.
In that way.
Yes, far less.
So anyway, if you left the ambulance driver, which presumably gave you a living, how did you get your living after that?
Oh, I got a job.
Mm.
You see, I think I told you I'm a typist, and I had shorthand then too. That was not difficult at all, not at all.
Mm.
I got a job with the Armstrong Sydney, with an Armstrong Sydney service garage, and. Do you want me to tell you these reminiscences?
No, that's interesting, because it's all leading up to the later developments, you know.
I was terribly shocked. I must have been very naive, really, to think that anybody in business is honest. And to find how dishonest it all was in the motoring trade. What the terrible lies that they told. And, of course, the fact that I really was not going to starve if I was sacked, and didn't really mind about it, I suppose made me braver than many people would have been, because I actually told old Sidley himself that I didn't choose to work anymore for somebody who would mislead their customers the way he did. He couldn't believe it that anyone would speak to him like that and want to employ me anymore. And I said I didn't want to be employed by him anymore, and that's why I was saying it. You see, I would never have done that, would I, if I had depended upon him for a reference, because he wouldn't have given me one. So, you see, I've really got a background of being, I'm rather ashamed of it now.
What, of being
why am I telling
bloody minded or something?
Yes.
I mean, yes.
Well, of being so sure, you see,
being principled, really.
That it didn't matter to me. I don't think it was really brave of me, is what I mean. Would have been brave if I had been absolutely dependent upon getting a proper reference from Armstrong Sidley.
Yes.
As it was, I don't think it was brave. And there are a lot of people who think I'm brave, and I know I'm not.
It must have been inconvenient, to say the least, to have to
leave.
Well,
it was inconvenient, yes.
You did actually leave, did you?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, I was sacked.
Yes.
Yes. Of course.
So what next?
Where am I now? Yes, in the middle of the war.
Well, this must have been towards the end of the war.
Yes, towards the end of the war.
Yes,
of course, towards the end. Well, I had a trip out to India about that time. My mother's sister was married to Sir Hugh Fraser, who had a job in India, and they invited me to stay with them. Well, perhaps my mother thought it was about time she got rid of me, I don't know. Anyway, I went to India, and that was a wonderful experience, a lovely experience. It's, except that I had already reached the really rebellious stage and thought that the British Raj was not what I wanted or believed in.
Mm.
Not at all.
So you felt a bit uncomfortable?
I did feel uncomfortable. But I stayed with some friends in Ceylon. I thought it was one of the most beautiful islands I'd ever been in. So that was, when was that? Then I came back.
That must have been after the war.
That was after the war. It was somewhere about 1920, I think.
Yes. How long
so you see, you're asking me something about what were we thinking of? Why didn't we get on a bit more, you see? And
you hadn't really joined the movement.
No.
Really, from the point of view of being active in the English Women's Movement.
No.
At that time, because the RSPU finished, didn't it?
Yes,
when the
it
war
finished.
Started.
It finished when the war started, yes.
Mm.
You see, some of the organisations have gone on. The Women's Freedom League did.
Yes.
And of course, when I met Dorothy just before the Second World War, she introduced me to Emily Bessett Lawrence, whom I hadn't met before.
Mm. I'm going to ask you something rather odd. Do you mind if I put a cushion over your clock? Because it's going to tick all do you mind?
Just put it outside.
Well, I don't want to sort of damage it. It
might. I won't damage it, not at all. No.
Well,
put it outside the door, of course.
Do you mind?
Not at all.
Because again,
no.
It's a lovely clock, but it'll come through.
It's a Victorian carriage clock.
Lovely clock, yes.
You see, they put them into little leather cases and carried them when they went abroad.
Yes, well, I just didn't want it to sort of spoil your account. But anyway, were you in India for very long then?
No, only 6 months.
Yes, I see. And you must have been moving in the highest circles, I mean, if you were had relatives in that sort of...
Well, I am... Yes, Government House and all that. Yes. Oh, very much. I don't play bridge, and my aunt said that I wouldn't get on at all well if I didn't play bridge. Nobody would want that. But as a matter of fact, there's something else I can do that it just happened that Lord Willingdon, who was Viceroy then, liked very much, and that is I can sing. And there was a stage, which I missed out of my story of my youth, when it was thought that I should be a singer. You won't think so now with my aged croaking voice, but I had very good vocal cords.
It was a very nice one.
And my German master, you know, in those days one learned to sing or play the piano and that kind of thing, or to get married, and this is what we were for. And he said I had a golden voice and that I ought to be a singer, but I didn't want to be a singer. So I wasn't, but I enjoyed singing and I had a
nice
voice.
It was a useful accomplishment for so forth.
Yes. So this is one of the things that at Government House they liked it very much. So despite the fact that I couldn't play a bridge, I wasn't really...
Did your Indian sort of experience have an effect on you permanently in any way? I mean, what did it strike you?
I think so. I think it made me a socialist, yes.
Did it?
It and Lloyd George, who would turn in his grave at the thought of making anyone a socialist, wouldn't he?
Yeah.
But he was the first person to take me away from my sort of Tory outlook.
You were impressed by him, were you? I mean, during the war?
Oh, I was, yes. I was.
Mm.
Though I'm sure he was a wicked man, really, but... no, I don't really mean that. But
not all
politicians, really. You can't really...
In retrospect, you probably wouldn't be as keen on him as you were at the time.
I don't think so. I don't think so. But but he certainly influenced me, yes.
Why was that really, do you think? I mean...
Well, giving you a different point of view about... You see, really I had been brought up to think that the people who you who were your servants, were inferior to you. I had been brought up to think that. And I suppose for a long time I was naive enough to believe what I was brought up to think. And then it turns out that it isn't true.
How did that strike? Did you go to a speech of his or something?
Well, I heard him speaking, yes.
Did you?
Once or twice, yes.
And he really rather impressed you?
Oh, yes, very much so.
The only thing is, he wasn't a socialist at that time.
Oh,
he's really
never a socialist.
Not very near it in retrospect, but
no.
I suppose he was very different from your
Oh,
family.
Very different from the talk. Mm. Oh, no, he was not a socialist. Mm. Of course he wasn't. No. Mm. Far from it.
Anyway, that started your slide.
Yes, that started my slide. yes, my slide.
Yeah.
The only other person whom I really compare to him, of course, was Jimmy Maxton. He was a lovely speaker, too. I often heard him.
You seem to be quite impressed by speakers.
Yes, well, I am myself, and was for a long time a speaker. Mm. I spoke on Tar Heel once a week for 10 years. And this is where I met, when I first became a doctor.
But even before you became a speaker, that was so...
I suppose I admired it and liked the idea of being able to...
Because I forgot to ask you, did the WSPU get you speaking?
No.
You're too young, really.
I don't... I think I probably would have quite liked to, but I was very young, yes.
Anyway, we've got you back from India now. What happened next?
It's not my life, you're right.
I'm just sort of getting you into the pacifist movement and then into the women's movement.
And then you carried on
getting various typing jobs, did you, or secretarial jobs?
Oh, yes.
After that?
I went into, well, not exactly into partnership, not at the time anyway, to a furnishing and decorating business with a friend of mine. In South Kensington, and she was the type of person who she advised people about their houses, and I went in with her as the sort of business manager of it.
Well, a good combination.
Yes, we were very successful, but the war, the Second World War. Nobody wanted to do anything about houses then. All they wanted to do was to get away from London and lodge somewhere else. Mm. So, in the end, that unfortunately collapsed. And I really became a professional pacifist, if one can call it that. In other words, I had a job with a paper called Peace News.
That was during the Second World War. And that was your last job, was it, or did you do any other jobs after that?
Well, no, my last job up to the age of 70 was in the peace movement, in the pacifist movement. Mm. But I worked at Peace News when John Middleton Murray was editor.
Yeah.
Murray, as you can imagine, if you know anything about him at all, was a man who couldn't stand my kind of woman, and I couldn't stand his kind of man.
How do you mean? I just might follow you on.
Well, Murray, he expected women to worship him.
Oh.
He expected all women to really think he was God. We used to call him God in the Peace News office, roughly, General Fleck, before we went in his room.
Yeah.
Not me. It's just a joke, really.
You've seen this new book by his son, have you?
I've read it, yes,
and
One Hand Clapping.
Terrifying person to be with, and the wife.
Have you read it?
No, I've only read the reviews.
Well, it's a beautiful book.
Is it?
It's extraordinary because, this is off the point, because he loved his father and wanted to be loved by him. Mm. And yet, somehow or other, even writing without any malice at all, you can see no malice, yet he's given him away. Oh, how he's given him away.
Yeah.
Father reminds me of Mrs. Conrad, who wrote a book about Joseph Conrad. She obviously adored him, but what a dreadful picture she made of him.
Anyway, you were running this sort of South Kensington, that explains, I suppose, why you're living here now, does it? I mean, you got attached to this part of London, did you? I mean, at that time?
I don't really know that. I've lived in Chelsea for about 40 years, yes.
Have you?
Yes.
Anyway, did you start off in your furnishing firm sort of around about the early 20s, or was it rather later?
No, it was about then, 1924, I think it was.
And you carried on that?
Even a little bit earlier than that, just when I came back. Yes, and I was there until the outbreak of the Second World War, till about 1938, I suppose.
So...
when we decided to cut our losses then.
Did you? Yes. Yes, that's rather a shame, isn't it?
Yes.
But what did you do in the peace movement then after you'd been converted? You converted round about 1917 or so.
Well, there it is, you see. I didn't really know any movement then. I now know that there was a movement called the No More War Movement. Though somehow or other I didn't make contact then. But somewhere about the early 30s, a friend of mine, same name as me but not a relation, John Morrison, now works with Christian Aid. He was one of Dick Shepherd's young men. Dick Shepherd was surrounded with some young men who helped him with all the things that he did. And I was introduced to him then. So it's a rather curious thing that it seems to be ministers of the church who've influenced me, and me, an atheist. But Dick was a very remarkable man. Now, there are some people who are a legend after they're dead, but he was a legend in his lifetime. So that's how I really came into the peace movement.
So he drew you in, Morrison?
Dick Shepherd wrote a letter in October of 1934 to the press in which he invited men, young men, who he thought of it as young men who would have to go to the war, who would send him a postcard saying, I renounce war and I will never support or sanction a man. And it is a very remarkable story that he thought that he would get a few. He had to go abroad and he left friends to receive the postcards when they came in at the address that we'd given. And they were shattered because hardly any came. And they said, whatever shall we say to Dick? He'd be dreadfully upset. When the post office rang up and said that there were bags and bags and bags of postcards and they wanted to know whether there'd be anybody there so that they could deliver. They could hardly believe it. It was some 100,000. You see, he was forced into forming an organisation. You can't just leave it like that. Yeah. I've written a book about that, you know.
Have you really? I have to read it.
Yes, I'll
let
you have.
What's the title, actually?
Called I Renounce War. Have
they?
I don't think I could get hold of something.
The weekly article on general peace questions, was it? Or what?
Well, what I did was to take a quote, probably, from something that was going on. They were very topical. I'll show them.
Sort of regular column, really.
Yes, I had a regular column, yes, yes.
So anyway, you were in on the Peace Pledge Union at the very beginning, were you?
Very beginning, yes.
And eventually, I presume it took more and more of your life, did it? I mean, as time went on.
Oh, yes, yes. I am, as a matter of fact, vice-chairman of the Status of Women Committee in this country.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm still interested in that.
Yes, well, I must get on to that in a moment.
Yes, well, I thought that's what you really wanted to know about, but perhaps not.
It's all going to add up.
Yeah.
But, anyway, did you sort of have a position in the Peace Pledge Union when you started?
Yes.
Off? I mean,
oh, not to begin with, no. I did the speaking for them on Tower Hill and then in Lincoln's Inn opening speaking. I did quite a lot of meetings. And I think it was somewhere about 1948 that I was appointed their campaign organiser. I did a lot of things then for them, like leaflets and posters and organising campaigns and that kind of thing.
A key position, really, isn't it?
Yes, well, in a way it was. It tells you all about it.
Thank you very much. Well, I shall read that about it. Thank you very much. So, you started speaking, really, public speaking, in the peace movement. Did you hadn't done any before then?
No, I hadn't. I started then.
They got you moving in a way.
Yes.
It must have been very difficult to get on a platform at the start, wasn't it? Or did you find it quite easy?
I've never found it very difficult, and I'm not at all good with notes, and I've never read a speech. I've always found that if I made notes, I always forgot to look at them, and then became confused and agitated that I should have looked at them. Perhaps I'd left something out.
Quite right.
So from then on, I really always spoke off the cuff. Yeah.
So you spoke in the streets like the suffragettes have done, actually.
Oh, yes, street corners.
Yes, did you really?
Yes, indeed.
Yes. I must have taken quite a lot of courage, because there must have been quite a lot of opposition.
Well, this is what people will say, you see, and this is what I mean. Isn't it? Oh, opposition, yes.
Yes,
you didn't have
hecklers
and
that.
Yes, a lot of opposition, that's true. But I don't really think I'm brave at all. I very well remember being on Tower Hill and speaking there when one of those terrible things came over. We called them, or I called them, buzz buggers.
I know, yes, sort of the V...
The things that cut out.
V-bombs, yes. Yes, I know.
And I was on Tower Hill and there was a big crowd when one of these things came over and they made a terrible noise. And of course you never knew when it was. And of course everybody who was standing about listening to the speakers lay down on their faces, very sensible. Me, I was petrified. I was absolutely terrified. I was petrified. I didn't move. I stood there like a fool instead of jumping down. So, of course, afterwards everybody said how brave she was. She was so brave. She never moved. She stood there. I was terrified. I only didn't move out of sheer... I can assure you that it was no bravery, no courage at all. It's all completely false. I don't think I'm brave.
One thing that's puzzling, you see, is a lot of the movements you join and the attitudes you have, you believe in principle and that sort of thing, really tend to go, in my mind, with nonconformity. But you've never been a nonconformist in any way, have you? I mean, in the sense of a Congregationalist or a Baptist or whatever like that.
No, I was baptised and confirmed and brought up in the Anglican Church. I'm not really quite sure when I decided that I didn't really believe.
But by the time you were working in London as an abbot's worker, you were going to Orchard's congregation.
I went
church.
To Kingsway, yes.
Yes.
Yes. And of course, he was, in a sense, he was rather given to ritual. See, which I don't know where the Congregationalists always are, because I had never known
anyone. I quite understand. So it's an easy transition,
yes,
in a way.
He was rather
understand.
Given to ritual.
So was that why you went there?
Maybe it was. I can't remember why I went there. I think a friend of mine went there and told me about it.
Yes.
And I was very impressed with him.
Yes.
He was a lovely man. He really was.
Why, again? I mean, it's rather difficult. A good speaker.
Yes, it's difficult to say. It's difficult to say, because he was quite different from Dick Shepherd. Who was really a much more homely man and not altogether a very good speaker, I don't think, except that he had this extraordinary way of engaging himself to the person he spoke to, as though you were the only person in the world, and that he really was interested in you and you alone. This is a very great gift for a pastor.
Yes. Whereas Orchard was more impressive, sort of in ceremony.
Oh, much more. Well, I thought so, yes.
Of Because the person who wrote, who's writing a biography of Orchard, Elaine Kay, is one of my neighbours at home.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she's already written a history of the Kingsway House Church.
And, oh, I didn't know this.
She's working on a biography of Orchard.
Oh, I shall want to read that.
I was really wondering whether, and let's switch to the 30s.
Yes, now we're into the
30s. And I now can see how you met up with Dorothy Evans, because
yes.
This was on while we were speaking. So how do you link up your WSPU days, which stopped in 1914, and your involvement later in the women's movement? Or had it been a continuous thing all the way through?
I don't think it had been a continuous thing. I didn't belong to any organisation until much later on, when I get a bit muddled with dates.
Doesn't matter the exact date.
No, but I was trying to think when the first Equal Pay Campaign Committee was set up under Mavis Tate. And then Thelma Caslett-Keir.
Between the wars, anyway,
yes.
Sometime
between the wars, yes. I was on these committees, I belonged to the Suffragette Fellowship, so that I was in touch in that.
I see. You went to these annual
luncheons
or teas or whatever.
Yes, and after Mrs. Fanker's statue was put up, they always have a meeting there.
You never joined the 6-point group at that stage?
Yes, not at that stage, no. I joined the 6-point group after I knew Dorothy. And really, you know, she was the 6-point group.
And she's another of these people who impress you strongly.
Oh, yes.
Because, you see, it's, if I can put all these things together, it seems to me your life, you've gone through life being influenced by, strongly influenced by a number of personalities.
Yes, I think I have.
And you have this capacity to be influenced by people, haven't you?
Yes, I think I have.
And she's only the last of a series of people who've
affected my life, yes. And in a way, I suppose, made me try to influence others.
Yes, precisely. It all goes
which
on.
I suppose was what I was doing when I was writing and speaking.
Of course, yes. It's interesting because you're what just kind of like Grace Rowe on that. And Grace Rowe, who you know, I expect.
Yes, of course, I know.
And she, when I was talking to her, her life is just like that as well. She's influenced by a number of people.
Yes,
you know.
Well, is this not possible that with that most people are?
Perhaps I'm the one who
become, what shall we call ourselves, crusaders for a cause. Now naturally, perhaps, more naturally influenced by others who are either thinking that way or who touch on your life.
It's almost like a sort of religion in a way, isn't it? I mean, just as religious people have leaders.
I think it is in a way,
yes.
Yes, I think it is.
Yeah. Anyway, so you've never really lost touch with the women's movement, but you haven't become active in it again. Really, until the late 30s, until after Dorothy Evans, or
yes, I think after Dorothy, yes.
Yes. What did she get you to do, though, Miss Morrison?
Nothing to do.
Because you're already busy enough in the past.
Yes, well, she had a great ability to get people to do things for her. Well, she got me to join the 6-point group, and I was on their committee. And I suppose that's really how I came to begin with, anyway, to represent them on the Equal Pay Campaign Committee. And that, I suppose, has led on to my eventually being on the Status of Women Committee and now being Vice Chairman to Joan Vickers, who is their chairman. And we're still working for equality. Equality of opportunity, anyway.
Yeah.
Well, I just don't happen to believe in legislation for this. I don't believe you can legislate for human behaviour. And I'm sure it'll just be a cause for seeing how you can get round it. It's so terribly difficult. Equal pay for work of equal value, how do you ever do that?
Yes, but attitudes have really changed markedly in the last 10 years, haven't they?
Yes.
Partly because individual attitudes have changed. But I agree with you, legislation can't achieve everything.
Undoubtedly.
So you moved up quickly in the 6-point group.
In a way, yes,
really, did
I think
you?
I did.
With Dorothy Evans'
yes.
encouragement.
I think on the whole I'm a good committee member, and I also thought it was important to learn to be a good chairman. So I took a lot of notice of people whom I thought were good chairmen. And I had a very a really splendid example in Dr. Alex Wood, who was chairman of the Peace Bread Union after Dick Shepherd died.
So you knew how movements were run long before you ever really became prominent in the women's movement.
Yes, I think so, yes.
So that's interesting. So it does all fit in, doesn't it?
Yes. I don't think I could call myself prominent in the women's movement. I think that in pacifist circles, yes, people would say I was prominent.
Mm. But what is the art of being a good chairman, then, do you think? And what did you have to learn?
Well, I think I learned a great deal from Dorothy, who was a good chairman herself, but she had a great ability to just cut through the things that people are talking about and getting off the point, to the point. And this, I think, is essential in a chairman, and not to be talking yourself, but to be listening and be ready to guide and clarify for other people. Mm. Not so much to guide as to clarify.
That's quite right.
Yes.
And Alex Wood was also good at this one.
Oh, he was wonderful, and he had rather a pretty wit and a dry humour that often saved a situation.
Because somehow you've got to do this without offending people.
Yes, you
have.
That's
the difficult thing.
And that is difficult with adult people. And I think, though I don't usually generalise about women, but I think that women are more difficult. I may be wrong about this, but I have a kind of feeling that they're more liable to be hurt or take offence.
And certainly less experienced in managing affairs, I suppose.
Whereas I've found on committees, because I've been chairman of the Peace Bread Union twice, for three years to now, I've found that working with mixed committees, men and women, that there isn't so much this sort of thing. And with politicians, you find that, well, there's the cut and thrust of debate, and you probably say a whole lot of rather offensive things, but you go out arm in arm afterwards.
Interesting,
yes. You know, it isn't a question of personal hurt.
Mm.
Whereas I do think, and it is a generalisation, I may be wrong, that women are more inclined.
Well, you
to
have
be
got
personal.
Comparative experience,
yes.
haven't you? Because you've been in largely male movement and largely female movement, and you can compare them, can't you? But are we now then on to one of the explanations, really, as to why the women's movement doesn't go forward as fast as you might expect? Do you think? I mean,
it hasn't gone fast, has it? When you come to think of it, that we're still on anti-discrimination bill.
Mm. But I think it's beginning to go fast now, but I don't think it went fast up to about the 1960s.
No.
And is it, I mean, the general impression I get is that there's a lot of infighting that goes on inside the women's movement. I don't know why. A lot of sort of jealousies and things like that, which of course Mrs. Billington Greg's an extreme example of, I suppose, and she's a difficult woman, really. Which in some ways made things difficult for the women's movement after Mrs. Pankhurst had ceased to be the prominent.
This may be true. I didn't. I really only came to know Teresa Billington Greig when, after Dorothy died, though she'd often told me about her. Because we invited her to organise the memorial meeting. We
for
had
Dorothy.
For her, yes. Mm. And she took us over. really, literally. So I don't think I am a proper person to ask about her, because I thought she was mistaken, I thought she was wrong about almost all the things she did.
She has this capacity for dismissing objections very sharply somehow,
yes,
doesn't she?
Yes.
Which
yes.
She hasn't got this chairman's knack, as you describe it, of disagreeing with people without offending them somehow. That's the problem, isn't it? But she did, I can't quite remember, did she become chairman of the six-point group? I can't quite remember
no,
what happened.
No, she didn't. Not the six-point group. It was the movement that Dorothy had formed at the time, just the time when she, just before she died, the Women for Westminster.
Oh, yes, yes.
And it was that she really took over.
I see, yes.
She really did.
Yes.
And though we were no longer able to be in Dartmouth Street, which was Rebecca Seif's office where she ran her newspaper from, we got an office in Paddington Street, which is just off Marylebone High Street. It wasn't a particularly nice office, but there were a couple of rooms, and there was a committee room. And Mrs. Billington Gregg was really running that office.
And she
took it out.
I can't remember, were you actually a member of the Women for Westminster?
Oh, yes, yes. Well. I worked in the office. Yes.
Did you?
I worked in the office, yes.
Did you?
After Dorothy died.
Oh, did you? I see. So
I hadn't then. I'd merely been a voluntary worker helping her.
Mm.
But I was asked to when she died, and was not expecting to be taken over by Mrs. Billington Gregg at all.
Mm.
And I really didn't get on with her. I didn't. And,
But how did you combine this with your work for the Peace News? Because weren't you doing Peace News?
Yes, in 1940, I left, let me see, I was with Peace News up till, yes, 1944.
Perhaps there was
a
hiatus there.
There was a hiatus, I think it was, yes. Because I went to work for PPU in 1948, and I certainly wasn't with Women for Westminster then.
Mm.
Yes, there was a hiatus.
Mm.
Yes.
How did she actually take over Women for Westminster? I mean, if you were right in the centre of things, how was it done actually?
Well, and I don't really like saying this.
Would you like to switch off while you're?
Perhaps, yes.
Do.
Yes.
I mean, what was Dorothy Evans' view of this PG then? I mean, as you said, she talked about a bit.
Well, she didn't only told me about her in regard to the time when they were in the struggle.
Yes, I see. She was an old fighter.
Yes, yes. And I don't really think she had kept in touch with her very much.
Mm.
I think so. She was not one of her friends. Charlotte Marsh, Monica Waitley, who wasn't in the Women's Social and Political Union, but who was chairman of the six-point group.
Mm.
And another Teresa.
Garnet.
Garnet.
Yes, yes.
Yes, she was very friendly with her.
Mm. Anyway, so you then left Women for Westminster after all
this. Yes,
and then you went into the PPU.
I remained in the six-point group.
I
well, I mean on their committee.
Yes,
yes,
yes, of course.
But I'd never been in any official position there.
Yes. Now, could you tell me what happened in the six-point group? Because you eventually became chairman
of
that.
Yes, I want
you?
To know this. I want to. Yes.
I mean, you stayed on the committee
for
quite a long
time. Yes, I was chairman for a time. I stayed in the committee, yes. I don't think I was chairman to begin with.
Mm.
I wonder who it was.
I can't, I'm afraid I don't
this
know.
This is terrible. I can't remember.
Doesn't matter, I just wondered whether you sort of recalled how you became chairman, sort of thing.
Well, I think the six-point group really was a committee more than anything else, though there were a few members. But I doubt if there have ever been more than a few hundred members. It was a committee, and it did a lot of useful work because Dorothy did it. You know, she was a tremendous organizer and worked hard herself and got other people to work for her. And as I say, she was the six-point group. And I think it must have been it was terrible that I can't remember, because I remember my friend Philip Valance was chairman for a time. But I was chairman, and then I think Monica Whateley took over from me.
Anyway, you became quite prominent, and you obviously knew what Dorothy Evans' ideas were, so that would What about, do tell me a bit about Monica Whateley, because she's floated through my horizon several times.
About her?
What was she like?
I didn't like her very much. It's terrible that that it's difficult to say when you don't like a person very much. Dorothy was devoted to her, and they were very great friends. She was a Roman Catholic and a teetotaler, and very keen on the women's movement. She was an attractive personality, very attractive. And like Dorothy, I see her in a cloak. Dorothy wore a cloak too. And a cloak and a black felt hat. Rather distinguished looking and attractive. Spoke French fluently. I don't know what else to tell you about her, really.
She was certainly very active, wasn't she, around about the 40s and 30s and
40s? Yes, yes. She stood for Parliament somewhere in the Limehouse, or I think it was Limehouse, one of those places up the river. She never got in, but she stood more than once. And I tell you what I do think was got into Parliament by Dorothy's efforts, that's Edith Summerskill.
Oh, yes.
Dorothy worked very hard for Edith.
Did she?
When she first stood down here at Fulham. And she was a terrific organiser. Any candidate for Parliament would be thankful to have her. Tremendous. Great energy, great knowledge about her. Get other people to do things for you. And never in a domineering way. Never.
Yes, I've written to Lady Summerskill, actually, and I hope she'll be able to see me, but I don't know. She's obviously rather busy and rather old now, but if she could.
Hope she will, yes.
Because she'll see things from the politician's point of view.
Yes, she was very devoted to Dorothy.
Was she?
And, very. And, she was very upset with me because, I don't know whether I told you this before or not, but when Dorothy was taken ill, when she died. She asked me,
cancer, yes, you did mention.
And
that.
I said yes.
Yes, still Lyndall doesn't seem to think that you were at all.
No, she doesn't, no. But Edith is a doctor, you see, or was. Before her parliamentary career, I assume she was a practicing doctor. And doctors think you shouldn't be told. I couldn't possibly insult Dorothy's courage and intelligence by pretending. I think she knew anyway.
What about Mrs. Pennock Lawrence? Did you see very much of her?
Not a lot, but I did meet her once or twice. We went down to her house to see her, and she was charming, I thought. Very, very lovely person.
She was a sort of figurehead, really, wasn't she?
Yes,
the six-point group, really, at that time.
Yes,
I mean, she didn't do anything active.
I don't think she did, but she her flat in Lincoln's Inn,
she still had that flat?
Oh, yes.
Did she?
Yes, she did.
So you used that?
Yes, and Dorothy was allowed to use that, and her secretary, Esther Knowles, who only died recently.
I know, she had an accident,
wasn't she? She was killed, yes.
Yes, I would have liked to have seen her.
Of course, she'd have been the very person. This is what is so awful, isn't it?
Yes, I mean,
because she really did remember things and did know things.
But anyway, you were then, presumably your energies were now more in the pacifist movement, really, weren't they? And your life alternates.
Patrick Lawrence was, well, as near as makes no odds, I think you'd say she was a pacifist. I wonder what I did. I've put it here. I've got a letter that's still interested in my courses. But they're not all that interested in the, you see, the freedom part should be, but it's a very cursory sort of interest in the egalitarian movement.
It's mainly international. It's
mainly the peace, international peace, yes.
So you've been chairman of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom for two periods?
Two periods of 5 years.
Have you really?
Yes.
And that's, and you only joined it sort of in 1955, really quite late.
Yes, quite late.
And you're still chairman, are you?
No, I'm not chairman of that.
I see.
I'm vice chairman of the Swiss Women Committee.
Oh, yes.
Which is an organisation which affiliates all the women's organisations, of which there are a very large number, you know.
There are, yes. Because isn't Miss... Popplewell, isn't she on that?
Mrs. Popplewell, yes.
Yes, Mrs. Popplewell, yes, I've met her.
Do you know her?
Yes, I met her in the Fawcett Library, actually.
Of course, yes. And I'll tell you another person who would know about Six Point Group, more perhaps than I do, and that's Roxanne Arnold.
Why was I arrested?
Yes, well, I think I was... there was a lot of heckling going on, and at the time, the General Secretary of the Peace Pledge Union had written to Gandhi, and Gandhi had replied at some length about what he hoped from Britain to do with this war, and I thought it was tremendously important, and I was telling them about it, and well, they were angry with me, you see, and there was a lot of heckling and shouting going on, and I can even tell you, the two policemen came up and fetched me down off the stand, walked me off. I can't remember now. There's a police station at the far side of Hyde Park. I suppose that must have been where I was taken. And I was charged with insulting words and behaviour liable to cause a breach of peace.
And then went off.
I had to. I was at the time living in rooms, not in my own. I hadn't got my own home at that time. And unless you're a householder, they won't take your own bail. So I had to get to telephone or let them telephone to a friend of mine who lived quite near to come and get me out. So meantime, I was locked up in a cell. I can assure you that those cells in key stations are appalling. There's no window, there's a bit of ventilation high up, quite as high as this room. There's all this little round hole. And there's a WC, and there's a thing you can lie down on, which had a very strange smell, I thought. And that's it. They were quite nice to me, the policemen. They joked and offered me cups of tea and all that sort of thing. But when I came to court, they were prepared to swear my life away. Don't ever trust a nice policeman. However, the magistrate said I was a very dangerous woman, and I suppose that I wouldn't have liked it. I said I was perfectly innocuous and go home.
But as it was, how long did you spend in prison then?
Only a month.
Yes.
But it's long enough to know what loss of freedom means. Mm. It's a great shock, loss of freedom. It's extraordinary what a shock it is. And that's what Dame Ethel Smythe said when she was asked, what did she most dislike about Holloway? She said, couldn't get out. And that's the answer.
Yes, I mean, in a way, it does save you from a lot of decisions, doesn't it? I mean, your life is managed for you,
yes, isn't it?
Oh,
yeah.
And it's a rest, in a sense, isn't it? I mean, I've never been in prison, so I don't know, but I mean...
when I was in prison, it wasn't a rest. It may be better now in Holloway, because they're shouting at you all the time.
Mm.
And everlastingly having to do something. And it is an extraordinary thing that what most people seem to mind. And I was talking to somebody the other day who works for the Home Office on prison things, looking after prison people. She said the same, that there are so many women who've never in all their lives been alone. They've either had four children in the bed with her or never been alone. And they're petrified, they're terrified. Screaming, crying.
You found that yourself.
I didn't want to be with anybody. I was thankful.
No, I really meant the other women there.
Oh yes, indeed.
Is that so?
Yes.
Who've been arrested because of the war? There were anti-war activities.
Well,
or?
No. I don't. I think I was the only person most of them had done rather petty things.
Mm.
They were either receivers of stolen goods or abortionists.
Mm.
That kind of thing. Women are not, this is a generalization, but I think it's true, they're not so violent in their offenses as men are.
Yeah,
they're really more petty things like forgery.
Yes.
Forgery and embezzlement, and all that sort of thing. Women going for, and I suppose it's rather good it is. And there was a girl when I was there, never forgotten, and I can see her now, she was quite young, and she'd been in remand homes since she was about 12. She was in on this occasion for a robbery of some kind. She was the type of person who gets inside a shop and hides behind something and stays and then lets somebody else in to rob it.
Mm.
And she was extremely kind to me. She thought I was rather put upon, that I wasn't competent to do the things. Neither was I. You know, when the officer said to me, can you do housework, I said no. And nobody had ever said no to that before. It was perfectly true. I've always paid to have my housework done. I think it's a boring thing.
Mm.
I'm a good cook.
Yes.
But housework, no.
Yes.
Yeah. So you see, to be kneeling down and doing fires in the officers' quarters, because I had what was considered to be a cushy job, housework in the officers' quarters. I was very bad at all this. This girl was most kind to me. She did a lot of things for me. And I didn't really want to reform her, but I thought I'd just ask her one day. You know, wouldn't it be nicer, really, to have a job and earn money? I've never forgotten. She looked at me in astonishment and said, no excitement. And she was quite young even then, not more than 23 or 4.
You lost touch with her since, have you?
Oh,
you?
Yes.
Mm. Very interesting, yeah.
No excitement. I would have thought it was enough excitement, wouldn't you? And what is the excitement in prison?
Well, I suppose the assumption is that you'll not get caught, isn't it?
Will you have some more tea?
No, another cup of tea.
Yes, of course.
Very nice.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Certainly. Is that lemon dew?
Yes, splendid, thank you, yes.
No self-question.
Mm.
But she did ask me what I was in for. And when I told her, she said, if you'd been in Germany, you'd have been shot. So I said, yes, I dare say. And she said, and that's what I'd do to you. So I said, forgetting that I wasn't in Hyde Park and shouldn't answer back. So I said, you mean you were sympathetic to Hitler's, point of view. Well, she hadn't expected that answer, and she was extremely angry. And you know, she took it out of me.
Did she?
Oh yeah. Mm. It's quite easy to, you see. And supposing that you say you want an appearance or something like that, and they don't give it to you, well, that's that.
Yes.
It's quite easy to be unpleasant, or if you've got a headache and you want an aspirin, you can get it.
Yes.
And she never forgave me.
Saying
that. Well, that's what she said. Yeah. She'd do the same to me.
Well, in a way,
Hitler.
It's the same mentality, isn't it?
Yes. Otherwise, no, everyone was nice to me, really. Particularly the prisoners. The officers, I think, were a bit shocked at me, but.
Yes.
You see, it was 1940, and it was the Battle of Britain. And it was really no fun. It's not amusing to be under bombardment and in confinement, really, isn't it? But they opened the doors in the women's prisons, you know. They thought men were tougher, or they were more afraid of men, and they wouldn't let them out, and I think that's terrible.
Mm.
Because though it's all nonsense, you can't really protect yourself. You have a sense that you can. You can move from where you are, and there was this idea that if you stood in the door, the lintels stood up.
I hadn't thought of that. Of course, the idea of being bombed and being shot in yourself.
Terrifying.
Anyway, did that? You didn't get imprisoned again. I mean, after that was your only occasion.
No, I didn't. The first time I went back to open air speaking, I was a bit. Nervous, but I didn't feel I could be intimidated into not doing it. You see, prison is supposed to be a deterrent, and I'm very uncertain about it, whether it is or not. And I'm not sure either that anyone has any right to use another person as a means to an end. I suppose that's really why I'm against hanging and...
You mean using people who have to get caught as a means to...
You see, there's really only one deterrent, isn't it? And that's the certainty of conviction, the certainty of being caught. I don't think you're deterred by hearing that somebody has gone to prison for life.
Well, certainly with your sort of offence, it's quite different from most offences anyway, isn't it? I mean, it's an
offence of principle, isn't it, really?
But anyway, you weren't put off. And did you feel the police were watching you or keeping an eye on you for the rest of the war?
Well, I have a feeling that I was on a dossier, yes, because when I was organiser for the Peace Bread Union, which was much later, much afterwards, we were organising and the war was over, and we were organising a torchlight procession. For some particular reason, I forget what it was now. And we had to get permission from the police to carry the torches. And two enormous policemen with silver braided hats. And I think they must be chosen for their height. Anyway, in my little room at Tig Shepherd House, they filmed it. About me. And I said, well, I was sorry if they wouldn't give us permission, but I was quite sure that we were going to do it, that we hoped we'd have permission and protection. And he bent down, took up his briefcase, ruffled through some papers and said, now let me see, you were in prison in 1940, weren't you? And I knew this was going to be it, you know, intimidation. Mm. They brought it along with them.
Mm.
So I'm sure I'm still there. Mm. And they won't let me be a prison visitor. I don't want to be now. I'm too old. But I would have liked to have been. I thought I did understand
of course
what the needs were.
Yes.
But you can't be if you've been inside.
I mean, anyone should be. It's somebody who knows what it's like.
Yes.
Mm. Anyway, that must have given you a sort of a real appreciation of what the suffragettes had gone through in a way,
didn't
it? I mean, because your situation was awfully similar to that.
Yes. But of course I was rather alone, you see. Anyway, it didn't occur to me to do anything like hunger striking. On the whole, I saw that they had reason to think that I had committed an offence. And the governor, it was just before Dr. Charity Taylor, it was a man, he said that I had committed a worse crime than any other person in the prison. And this is what he said to me. And as there was a woman there who murdered somebody, it seemed to me that I, who was refusing to murder... Oh, yes, he was...
Mind you, it was the period of great hysteria, wasn't it, during the Battle of Britain, I suppose.
They were certain... You know, there was one side of the Holloway was occupied by internees, and they were mostly German. Plus Mosley. He was there when I was... Not that we were allowed to be. I don't know who would have been contaminated, whether it would be mostly or me, but we were just, the convicted prisoners weren't allowed to have anything to do with the internees. But my companions in prison were certain that the internees were signalling to the aeroplanes so that the bombs would be dropped, as though they would signal to have the bombs dropped on them.
Well, presumably they might signal to have the bombs dropped on some other part of the prison so that they could break out, perhaps, and that might...
They really were very, very hysterical, but it was rather natural. It was awful, you see, because other prisoners were coming in and they were telling these terrible stories, and all these people, whatever wickedness they'd committed, there was somebody outside they loved. All were connected with either their children or their husband or their lovers. They all had someone whom they minded about and whom they cared about. And it really wasn't.
Because it had never occurred to me, your point about women being more unused than men to being on their own, of course that makes the suffragette achievement even greater, doesn't it, in a way? Because certainly middle class women at that period wouldn't have been used to being on their own at all.
And Constance Lytton, who was given privileged treatment, you know, she made this great struggle to not to be given privileged treatment.
Yes.
And I'm afraid she suffered, she died before she did have, I think.
Yes, well that's true. Mm. She wrote a very interesting book called Prisons and Prisoners.
Yes. Did you see the Shoulder to Shoulder
series? Yes. Interesting series, actually.
Yes.
Quite wrong in some ways.
Quite interesting. But interesting, in lots of ways, very interesting.
How do you feel, I mean, as a person who's very, very active and been very active in the women's movement for the last sort of 50 years, really, in effect?
Yes.
How do you feel then about women's lib? Why do you diverge from it?
I don't really think I ought to. It was the beginning of the thing, burning your bras and all that.
I see, sort of exhibitionism of it.
Exhibitionism, yes. Well, I've no right to say that, because of course all the breaking of windows was a kind of exhibitionism, wasn't it, to attract attention. Because I have met quite a lot of the women's lib. I was invited to be on one of those things that follow Eamon Andrews on the ITV, when they had a woman speaking, a man and a woman. I can't remember who she was, but anyway, she was ghastly. She was the sort of person who said that it was high time that the world became a woman-dominated world, because the men had just made a mess of everything, and they were all, you know, all bad, all sorts of different badnesses.
Yes, yeah.
Unbelievable. Well, those of us who had invited to be an audience, and I had spoken to Eamon Andrews in advance, and he had said to me, I want to get you in, so you know, there are more people there than can be all got in. And there were a lot of young women libs. I've been talking to them in the period before you get together and you have drinks and you talk. And, and I don't suppose I really thought that they would be on that woman's side, but I wondered. So when I had my opportunity to catch his eye, because he caught mine and was able to say that there are a whole lot of rather unpleasant women in the world, as well as a whole lot of rather unpleasant men. But that fortunately there are more pleasant people than unpleasant people of both sexes. Because I thought it was deplorable, and absolutely no argument whatever, you see, for any cause. And
purely
I was not only did all these young people, because they were all young, these women, they not only did they applaud me, but they supported me. Yes, oh, they did. And in talking with them afterwards, and a lot of them spoke to me afterwards and said they were so glad I'd said what I had, but they didn't all get a chance to say something. And I was really quite converted round to them. Because they weren't on her side. They weren't at all.
Yes. Was it wasn't Germaine Greer, was it?
That's who it was.
Was it? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Shocking speech.
Awful woman, yeah.
Well, I couldn't believe it.
Mm.
And when Eamon Andrews came up to me afterwards and said, would you like to be introduced to her? I said, no, I wouldn't. I cannot see why. What I would have to say to her. Because I'd been pretty forthright when I'd spoken.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
One thing, we should mention that article actually, which we have discussed, is political parties. It says they voted Labour.
Yes.
You've always voted Labour.
Yes.
But then for two elections, I think you didn't vote at all because you thought the Labour Party was wrong on civil defence.
Right? I was very upset with a thing that, in fact, I'd resigned from the party. I'd been a paid up member.
Yes.
Attlee produced a thing about how to protect yourself against the bombs.
Mm.
This nonsense about brown paper and sandbags, and it's such nonsense. And I don't believe in conning people. I really don't. I don't.
You mean it's just ineffectual?
Absolute nonsense.
Yes.
Couldn't have been the slightest bit of use to
it.
And even that always carry your gas mask, when you know that we were given gas masks that hadn't any resemblance to what soldiers and policemen had. They'd have been much use sick headache, but really.
Mm.
But I don't believe in being conned. I was really upset by it.
Mm.
I dare say it was the last straw.
Mm.
Anyway.
You always felt slightly dubious about the Labour Party. I mean,
well, I think I'm a bit of an anarchist, really.
But anyway, so you did that stop you voting Labour altogether, or what?
Well,
have you voted Labour since then? Or maybe
yes, you can ask me. I've never voted Conservative.
Mm.
That would seem terrible to me.
So not to your parents?
No. No, but here, where I live now, where I've lived for so long, in Chelsea, it's a safe Tory seat. So what I've really done, so as not to waste my vote, because after all that struggle, I don't want to be disenfranchised. There's usually been somebody else, some crank.
Mm. Somebody who might have a chance, who's not Labour.
Yes. Well, Labour doesn't have a chance here.
Yes.
Not at the moment.
Yes. One thing, you never told me your mother's name, actually, your mother's...
Oh, her maiden name, Fawcett. Her second man.
Well...
She was Fawcett, born Fawcett.
Any relationship?
No, I don't think so.
Mm.
No. Born Fawcett, married Morrison, and then she married Parker, was her name.
Mm. But really wondering, are you sort of unusual in your family connections, in the position you've taken politically?
Yes, I think
or is there an ancestry somewhere? I mean,
I don't think so.
You don't feel there's any sort of family
background? I don't think so. There's a sort of artistic ancestry that my grandfather painted, but he wasn't well known, but he
your maternal grandfather,
yes.
You mean? Yes.
My paternal grandfather, but no, I don't think so at all.
Mm.
It'd be rather ordinary middle class family.
Mm. I mean, it's absurd to try and explain
yes, it is rather absurd.
Attitudes by their social background anyway, but sometimes there is a tradition in a family of being radical, being anti, and so on. But really, you'd see yourself as an anarchist, would you? I mean,
oh yes.
Meaning no government.
Well, now I would. At any rate, a philosophical anarchist. Mm. And as I think I said to you, I really do want decentralisation. I would like to go back to to small groups.
Mm.
And all this big stores, and, you know, everywhere you go, there's a Woolworths, there's a Sainsbury's, there's a Boots. And in the Sunday Times Pictorial last Sunday, there were some lovely pictures of little shops where people have still got their own thing. Up here at the World's End, we've still got a baker who bakes on the premises and who knows you by name. Mm. But it's going, isn't it?
It is. It's quite true. I agree with that. Yeah.
Still, you're young and you think it's all right. You see,
no, I don't
say
think
it's old-fashioned.
No, it's not at all. I mean, rather modern of you actually to think these things. I'll switch it off because I don't want my. I think I know it because I think
yes.
I'm
sure you would.
That.
It's in the highway.
But it's a very upper class school. I mean, in a way, one would have thought that you wouldn't have enjoyed it there because it wouldn't contain many rebels. But was that not the case?
I don't think it did contain any rebels. No, I think we were moulded there. I think, like all public schools, you're in a mould, aren't you? But the thing is, if you're good at games, you're usually popular.
Mm.
And I should say that's probably true at a boys' public school.
Oh, you bet it is. I remember that.
Yes. Where did you go?
I went to Merchant Taylors in Northwood. Mm.
Oh,
and,
yes.
You know, it was a games school.
Yes.
Very
yes,
much
of course.
But so did you become head girl or anything like that? I mean,
not head girl, no, captain.
Did you? Captain of?
Yes.
Is that, what does that mean?
Well, games, you know, games.
I see, yes. Not just captain of the hockey team, but captain of games in general. Yes, I see. Because I would have thought, you see, I would have expected you to react against Whitfield Abbey.
Yes, of course, of course.
You only
I suppose I waited till afterwards.
Yes.
You know, I really was very happy at Wickham. I loved it.
Mm.
One, it's a beautiful place. It really is a lovely place.
Mm.
The Abbey is very interesting, beautiful, the grounds are lovely. And there was a big lake. I learned to punt, canoe and all the proper things.
And to play lacrosse, which you preferred to.
Oh, it's a lovely game, yes. Yeah.
But did you.
I didn't go on with it afterwards. I would have had to join a car, but all these things come around were difficult.
You never had a mistress there who influenced you as strongly as your literature mistress?
No.
No,
not at all.
One thing I did mean to ask, I completely forgot, was about medical things and doctors and that sort of thing. There are quite a lot of people who are vegetarians. I mean, we discussed this with Dorothy Evans in the women's movement, or people who are anti-doctor and so on. Have you ever felt along those lines at all?
I meet a lot of vegetarians in the pacifist movement.
Mm.
I'm not a vegetarian myself.
Mm.
I always feel that I haven't really got a leg to stand on in any discussion with vegetarians. They don't wish animals to be treated in this cruel way. But I don't really see the connection with pacifism, though they do.
Yeah.
I see that they do.
Yes.
Because it's no good, you know, if I saw a wasp, I'd certainly swat it. And I'll do what I can to get rid of flies. I don't want to poison mice, and I'm glad to say I don't have any mice. Because this room is once a garage. Oh, I'm showing you the studio, because you'd like to see it.
Yeah.
It's in a bit of a muddle, because I was ironing before you came, but
you'd
like to see it, because
because
it looks out onto the river, and it's very attractive.
Yeah. No, if that suits you. But you never were carried forward then into vegetarianism, or into any sort of health food sort of movement or anything like that.
No.
Because they quite often do go together.
Yes, they do go together,
And there's a strongly anti-doctor aspect about the women's movement, the suffragette movement too, actually, which of course the whole forcible feeding
business
confirmed.
Yes, it was that, wasn't it, really, yes. It was a shocking business there, wasn't
it? Oh, terrible, that's so frightful. Do you remember talking or hearing people talking about forcible feeding when you were a young woman? I mean, did they come and talk about it at all?
Oh, yes. Mm. And, of course, Dorothy told me a lot about it. She was forcibly fed several times.
Mm.
And I think she was in prison about 9 times.
Yes, she was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, of course, it was a terrible thing, really, that forciness.
Mm. Oh, awful. And as Lyndall said, it damaged her throat permanently.
Yes.
Afterwards, even though the doctor said it didn't.
Yes.
But it's interesting that you haven't sort of followed that line.
No, I haven't.
But there is a connection, isn't there, between all these movements in the 20th century, if you look at England.
Yes.
The women's movement, the suffragette movement, the anarchist movement, the peace movement, mm-hmm. they're all connected,
yes.
aren't they?
Yes,
really?
I think they are, really. A great many of the people who were in the No More War movement in the First World War, like Fenner Brockway,
yes.
people like that, they were all keen feminists.
Yes, absolutely.
And supported the suffragettes.
Yes. And there was a split in Mrs. Fawcett's organisation, wasn't there, about peace in 1915.
Yes, I think there was. Yes,
which was really raised there. So I must stop now, but